You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Mike Rowe has taken on some of the toughest and most disgusting jobs on Earth. Now the host of Discovery's Dirty Jobs is putting in just as much work, along with some elbow grease, to prove once and for all that everything in the world is connected in an all-new series for Discovery's new streaming platform, Discovery+. In each episode of 6 Degrees with Mike Rowe, he transports himself back in time to some of the most major moments in history and connects the dots between these events, revealing incredible stories along the way. Can a mousetrap really cure your hangover? Did a garbage man give us a glimpse into the Big Bang? And how can a horseshoe help you find the perfect soulmate? With his wry sense of humor and candid, no-nonsense take, Mike links society's most taken-for-granted moments to their surprising origins and all the way to our modern world. And today, I'm happy to welcome Mike Rowe to the podcast to talk about the party game that inspired his latest show, his own habit of getting lost down rabbit holes on Google, especially when history's involved, and how he's bringing everything and everyone from puppets and animation to his high school best friend to make history fun on 6 Degrees. He also reveals how he faked his way into his first job as an opera singer, some of the strangest products he used to pitch as a late-night host on QVC, and the hardest thing he ever had to do during his 9 seasons as host of Dirty Jobs. Plus, he shares where he gets his famous work ethic, what he's doing to help young people find honest work in the vocational trades, and why he believes that 4-year colleges are becoming increasingly out of touch. Coming up with Mike Rowe in just a moment. Today I'm talking with Mike Rowe, who is perhaps most famous as the host of the Discovery Channel series Dirty Jobs, as well as the million other things that he's constantly up to, including his Mike Rowe Works Foundation. Now he's out to prove that the world really is connected and history is surprisingly relevant to our lives today with a new series called 6 Degrees with Mike Rowe, which is currently available on Discovery's new streaming service, Discovery+. Mike Rowe, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Ben. How are you?
I'm just great. And I really like this show because I'm just such a big history nut to begin with. And I love it when shows have a fun and unconventional way into history. Plus, just how nice that Discovery finally gave you a show where you don't have to dive into sewers or risk your life on a crab boat. This must feel like downright luxurious compared to the last one.
You know, it's funny. Everything's a trade-off. Dirty Jobs was physically a very difficult show to do, but it was also a very easy show to produce because we never did a second take. We never did a rehearsal. We never did any pre-production. It was never about that. It was just going through the day, doing whatever happened and chronicling the whole thing. Mm-hmm. This is different. You know, this is a history show for people who normally wouldn't watch a history show. But basically, I'm making the case and showing you how to connect two seemingly disparate objects. And so really, it's a giant monologue that is delivered and constantly being interrupted by recreations, puppets, animation. I mean, we literally throw every production device we have at the screen. And I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, I loved it. And I like this idea of kind of going through history from one thing to another and, you know, building that connection. Plus, just this show is literally every day of my life. I am constantly drawn into rabbit holes within rabbit holes within rabbit holes. Just the other day, I was intently reading something on my phone and my wife was asking, what am I looking at? And eventually, she takes the phone out of my hand and just stares at it incredulously because I think she was just dumbfounded how I even got started down the path that ended up with a Wikipedia page for the voodoo demigod Baron Samedi.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
pretty much my life. So,
no,
are you,
look,
are you that, prone to rabbit holes too?
That it, that very experience, that feeling right now that most everybody has had, is the thing we're trying to reconnect to, and it really is difficult to describe. But it happened to me. I remember the first time. Do you remember when that? I guess it was a meteor that crashed into that unpronounceable town in Russia up near Siberia.
Oh, yeah. Was it Tunguska?
Yeah, something like that. That's very close.
Yeah.
That was like 6-7 years ago, I guess. And I just had so many questions. Like, how did it get past the satellite net? How did we not see that coming? How did it, you know, it's like, what in the world? And so I went online and I started looking around at meteors. And I don't remember what happened over the next 2 hours. I just remember taking an incredibly deep dive into Leonard Bernstein's lectures at Harvard when he talked about the circle of fifths and the way the polyphonic scale ultimately came into existence. And that's when it hit me. It's like, if I can go from a meteor in an unpronounceable Russian town to Leonard Bernstein explaining the circle of fifths, then truly any two points can be connected.
And yeah, that's a pretty wild route that you went on there. I don't know. I'm curious, how did you get to Leonard Bernstein from there?
I really couldn't tell you because I wasn't headed for Leonard. I was just going wherever I went. But Leonard is where I landed.
Yeah.
And so had I been paying attention and maybe not had so much wine, I might have gone back and rerouted my search history just to see what the hell happened.
Yeah. If I have the right story here, there are a lot of ways you could go with that meteor crash, because isn't that the one that there are theories it might have been an alien craft or a nuclear blast and all kinds of different conspiracy Everything. Theories and stuff around it. So
you could
land just about anywhere off of that.
That's right. And the further you go, look, it's the old parlor game, right? 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon,
right?
And the old working assumption that any two people on the planet are 6 degrees apart,
right?
Six connections apart. That was really the beginning of the show, Ben. I mean, we were just sitting around with some reasonably intelligent writers one day, and I said, let's do a show that feels like, you know, we all had some bourbon, but right. but not so much that it makes us sloppy, but enough so that the show we make never feels like a lecture or a sermon. You know, let's have as much fun with history as I had with Dirty Jobs, and let's see what that looks like.
Right, and there is that element of a somewhat inebriated conversation that opens things up to kind of go where the conversation takes you. So you don't have to stay on that narrow path, which I love about it. And have you ever played 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon?
You know, I'm sure I did. I mean, I played it enough to know how it works. He's going to see this at some point and probably be like, you know, you should have called me, man. But you know, I'm sure he wasn't available.
I'm curious though, when you guys were researching and writing an episode of this, do you go about it like a game of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with a beginning and an end? Do you find connections along the way? Do you start at the start? Do you reverse engineer it from the end? How do you do something like that?
Well, the first thing you do, in this format anyway, is find the big thing in the chain. Like, what's the big thing? Like, if we want to do a story that fundamentally tells you how Google came to be, then what you would do is you would learn what you want to learn about Google, which is probably a bunch of stuff you know already, and call that the fifth degree. Then you would say, all right, so let's work back. You know, how far back can we go, and what main points do we want to make in history that can actually get us there? And in that particular case, I went all the way back to the Civil War and found a cookbook that fundamentally changed everything, because the food that the Union Army was eating back in 1860 was just awful. Half the guys had diarrhea. The other half had dysentery. There were maggots everywhere. I mean, it's just horrible, horrible, horrible. And these Civil War soldiers were really hungry. Mm-hmm. So I tell the story of the guy, James Sanderson, who created the first cookbook that was used in the field, and the impact that had on the war. And of course, that war was won by the Union, and that led to the Union stockyards. And so the demand for meat when his book really circulated was huge. And so we look at the impact of meat byproducts as well as meat, and what that did to the railroad industry, and how the meat byproducts were used in sporting goods. And then we learned that Newt Rockne and Charlie Bachman, who invented the forward pass once upon a time for Notre Dame, well, Charlie had a son named Charles, and Charles Jr. used the whole notion of a forward pass. You know, at the time they played football in a way that didn't require, right. there was no passing game. But it was Bachman who realized that the notion of throwing a pass applied to the business of rewinding and winding tape spools would have a huge impact in terms of the speed which you could search for something. So IDS was born, which led to Google, of course. And then the final question is, all right, well, what does Google allow us to do? And the answer to that is so many different things. So I just randomly picked, well, how does it allow us to produce this episode of Six Degrees? And the answer to that is in every way imaginable, mm-hmm. because that show is produced and fact-checked in many cases in the field.
Right.
We're constantly using Google to confirm or reaffirm a dozen different things, not just in the chain we're creating, but in the actual physical production of the show. And so what winds up coming out the other end after some bourbon is, okay, how did a hungry Civil War soldier produce this show? And an hour later, you know, you touch on everything I mentioned, plus 10 other things, all of which right. are then brought to life with whatever production component suits us. Could be animation, could be puppets, could be cheap recreations with community theater actors in dubious costumes, could be archival footage, could be anything.
Yeah, and you touched on something that is one of my favorite aspects of this show. Because you take sort of the scenic route through history, you get to introduce audiences to so many forgotten heroes and random people who, you know, maybe did something very big but have been forgotten to history, especially a lot of inventors, many of whom didn't always see their big payday or get their due in their time. One of these people, although I think that he definitely saw his share of success, was one who's in that episode, Gustavus Swift. Now, here's one for your Dirty Jobs fans. He revolutionizes the meatpacking industry and literally found ways to use the whole hog. What can you tell us about that guy?
Everything but the squeal, yeah. He said. Yeah, Swift changed everything. He invented a refrigerated railroad car. And until that point, you really couldn't ship meat. You know, you kind of had to run the cow itself. It just didn't work. But once he figured out how to get a carcass onto a refrigerated railroad car and send it anywhere, well, that drove the railroads to build more tracks. And that just changed everything. Mm-hmm. And while he was perfecting the modern day slaughterhouse, which was truly I mean, it's just unspeakable. If you haven't read The Jungle, you know, Upton Sinclair, I mean, my God. But, you know, Swift was right there at the beginning of that. And he was also creating all of this waste, all these meat byproducts. And one of them happened to be, catgut, which they used for tennis rackets and violins. And he had a partner, a guy named Wilson, Thomas Wilson, you know, who became Wilson Sporting Goods mogul. That all came out of the meat industry as well. And so it was through Wilson that we actually get to Newt Rockne. You know, Wilson was making footballs out of pig bladders at the time, coming out of Swift's operation. And so when they finally figured out how to make a more efficient football, Newt Rockne and Charlie Bachman were there to perfect the forward pass. And so just, you know, you could spin this thing in a thousand different directions and you can tell the story in a thousand different ways. But, you know, to answer your earlier question, part of it too is when you write it, you just kind of sit down and say, well, you know, what would people like to know as just a little, did you know, just a little bit of water cooler chatter.
Right.
Well, Charles Newbold invented the iron plow when he was 16, 17 years old. And the iron plow, in an episode called How a Horseshoe Can Find Your Soulmate, completely transforms agriculture. I mean, it literally brings in the agricultural revolution. And so that little bit of information all by itself is kind of interesting. And you could take it and you could make an hour show out of it. Or you could just spend 3 or 4 minutes on it and make it a link in a chain. And if you do that, then you leave yourself enough time to build the chain as long as you want and send a viewer home with just, you know, 10 pounds of crap in a 5-pound bag is what I want the show to feel like. So much information. Yeah. And we're going to throw it all at you as best we can and bring you along for the ride.
And much like Six Degrees, your career has had a very circuitous route to where you stand today. I dove a little bit into your bio and was sort of interested to learn that you started out as an opera singer. In fact, it says here that you faked your way into the Baltimore Opera. My question is, how do you fake your way into an opera? I mean, you either can sing or you can't, right?
Well, to a degree, I mean, you certainly have to be able to carry a tune, but you also have to be lucky. Back in 1982 or 83, that was, I guess, the Baltimore Opera was looking for young men with low voices. And I happened to check both boxes, and I knew a guy who was in the opera. I had no interest in the opera per se. I just wanted to get my my equity and my SAG union card so I could work in TV and film. And that was sort of the back door in to get that card, right? Anyway, they had open auditions last Thursday of every month where anybody could come in and sing an aria. And I learned the shortest aria I could find. And I went to the open call on a Thursday afternoon, and I sang it as loud as I could. I still remember the chorus master, a guy named Bill Yannuzzi, looked at me when I was done and said, Mr. Rowe, you have no idea at all what you're singing about, do you? I said, no, I really don't. I literally gone to the library and said to the librarian, I need the shortest aria you can find for a bass baritone. And she gave me Puccini's La Boheme. And I memorized it. Yeah, it was the coat aria.
Okay.
And it was so weird. I remember walking around Baltimore where I was living at the time with a Walkman, a Sony Walkman.
I remember those.
Listening to Samuel Raimi sing this aria over and over. I had no idea what he was singing about. I had no idea what the sounds of the words meant. I was just basically trying to memorize it as best I could and then recreate it.
Now, like you, I'm always interested in hearing the trade secrets of various jobs. What's something most people probably don't know about performing in the opera?
Oh, well, the stink, man. I mean,
really?
The costumes are generally very heavy and they're made of burlap, you know, and, you just sweat to death on stage under those lights. Mm. And, Yeah, it's just you just can't get the stink out of them. They smell like a hockey outfit most of the time. The spit. I mean, the amount of spit that flies through the air. It's just, it's mind-blowing. When you see these, you know, big tenors face-to-face with these big sopranos and they're screaming each other's faces. You get close enough, man, you're just looking at snot bubbles and saliva and all kinds of stuff flying through the air. It's a fairly disgusting.
Not a COVID-friendly job then, I guess.
No, it is not, man. And I feel bad for opera companies all over the country now. Yeah. They're all shut down. But I mean, it's a, I wound up staying in the opera 8 years, Ben. The music was better than I thought. I had a great time. I didn't plan. I was just going to get my union card and leave. But I stuck around. I learned a few things. And really, look, when you're 23 years old, dressed like a pirate or a Viking, and you're surrounded by, you know, 25, 30 co-eds from the Peabody Institute, and, you know, most of the guys don't have any interest in any of the girls. I'm going to maybe stick around.
Good numbers there, huh?
Target rich.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Somewhere here along the 6 degrees of Mike Rowe, you have this unconventional leap that you make then from opera singer to on-air host for the Home Shopping Network, or for QVC, I think. How did that happen?
That was the one. Yeah, that was, God, it seems so impossible, you know, when you put it that way, but now looking back, it was inevitable. You know, I was in the middle of a production of Der Ring des Nibelungen, I think, on a Sunday afternoon, and, you know, interminably long opera with a long intermission, and I didn't need to be on stage for like an hour and a half. I was just in the chorus. So I walked across the street dressed as a Viking to watch the football game at the Mount Royal Tavern.
Were the Vikings playing?
That would have been too rich. But no, the game wasn't on. I mean, it should have been on, but the bartender was watching a fat guy in a shiny suit sell pots and pans. And I'm like, Rick, what are you doing, man? I'd like, let's watch the game. He said, I got to watch this guy. There was another audition. QVC was in town holding an open call because they were looking for hosts. So I sat there dressed as a Viking, drinking a beer, arguing with Rick about the fact that I believed I could get a call back if I went to the audition with him. He was a fellow actor, guy I'd known for a while. So we basically made a bet, and I went with him the next day down to the Marriott in a Harbor Place to audition for a show host on the QVC cable shopping channel. And in that audition, a guy set up a camera, talk about the pencil for 8 minutes. Don't stop. Until I tell you to. And that was it. That's how they auditioned for a host in those days. If you could talk about a pencil for 8 minutes, they gave you a 3-month probationary contract. Made it through that, you had a job.
That's amazing. What were some of the products that you hawked on QVC?
My God, all of it, man. I mean, mostly, like, if you got through the pencil audition and you made it on the air, they didn't train you, because there really is no training program. It's kind of a baptism by fire. So what they do is they put you on the air at 3 in the morning, 3 to 6 a.m. And you sit there trying to make sense of the products that didn't sell in prime time.
Okay.
Right. Oh,
great.
So the you know, the Amcor negative ion generator, the Health Team infrared pain reliever, Diamondique, Yves Rocher perfumes. I mean, it's just, you know, electronic mosquito repellers, eel skin wallets from Lee Sands. It was just endless. Wow. It was like the stuff you would expect to find in one of those machines on the Carnival Midway with a claw. You know,
right. Yeah, exactly.
So, I sat there for 3 hours a night trying to describe these things. And basically that's it. That's how you learn.
Yeah. And, What was your biggest seller?
In general, jewelry did really well on QVC, but probably just because we sold so much of it. You know, I remember the first thing they gave me was this Health Team infrared pain reliever. I write about it in my book actually, because it kind of it was a huge lesson. But this is it looks like a little flashlight with a red knob on the end, and you plug it in, and it emits infrared light, which purportedly makes your arthritis feel better.
So let's be honest. Basically, it was a flashlight.
I honestly thought it was a joke. I just thought somebody's pulling my chain. This is like I'm being punked or something. But it was the first thing they gave me to sell. And I looked in the camera and I said, hi, everybody. I'm Mike. I'm the new guy. And I'll be here for the next 3 hours. And this is the Health Team Infrared Pain Reliever. It's $19.99. I don't really understand what it is. I don't understand how it works. And I'm not 100% sure why anyone would buy one. But if you have one, do me a favor and call the number on the screen and ask for Marty. The producer will put you through and maybe you can explain to me what the hell this thing is.
Nice. You crowdsourced it.
I crowdsourced it and I stole from Mark Twain, Tom Sawyer, Paint the Fence, right?
Oh, yeah.
although I didn't really know I was doing that at the time. I just genuinely didn't know how to talk for 8 minutes about a flashlight with a red knob on the end.
Right.
The phones exploded. At 3 a.m, I mean, dozens of people called in and the producer put them on the air. And we had a great time. I sat there while these people basically did my job. And, you know, it wasn't a testimonial call, although they did own the product. It was a, hey, let me help you out. Let me tell you how it works. So it was some testimonial in it, but mainly it was just me throwing myself at the mercy of the viewers. And in some way, shape, or form, I've been doing that ever since.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I haven't watched QVC in a very, very long time, but as I recall, it was a little bit like listening to Coast AM in terms of the kind of people who call in at that hour. What kind of person is the typical late night QVC viewer/caller/buyer?
At the time, 1989, 1990, it was a combination of night owls, lonely hearts, big drinkers, and reprobates. You know, they were people. In many cases, QVC had a big audience in those days in the red states, in the rural part of the country, because, you know, they couldn't get to a mall. And, you know, the whole notion of having products delivered to you, I mean, it was revolutionary. But at night, it wasn't so much about the shopping. People bought stuff, but it was really about company. People wanted company. They were lonesome, and so they watched because it was a friendly face at the door. And sometimes they'd buy something. And yeah, I mean, it was a very weird mix for me because I never took the job seriously. I shouldn't have been hired. You know, like I said, I auditioned to settle a bet, and once I got on the air, I started looking for ways to get myself fired because I didn't really want to do that for a real length of time. But like the opera, it actually became kind of fun. And the whole notion of a steady paycheck, you know, which is something I had never experienced before.
Yeah.
I was into it. So I was on thin ice for 3 years, got fired 3 times, and stayed on a kind of double secret probation for most of my tenure.
Now, you're best known for your 9 seasons hosting the hit series Dirty Jobs on Discovery. And I have to ask, how did you first get into something like that? I'm assuming that jumping into sewers and inseminating cows weren't at the top of your bucket list. So was it just a slow couple of months and it's a paycheck or what? How does one end up in there?
You know, I thought that's what it was going to be. After QVC, from 1993 until 2001, I had maybe 300 different jobs. Mm-hmm. I worked for every cable network. I impersonated a host pretty well on a lot of different shows. I did talk shows. I did game shows. I produced all the content for American Airlines and hosted their shows in flight, all kinds of weird, random things, a lot of infomercials and so forth. And I had a pretty good, career going. I mean, I wasn't making a lot of money, but I was making enough and I could work whenever I wanted, you know. And Dirty Jobs happened because my mother called me. I was working at the time as a correspondent for CBS here in San Francisco on a show called Evening Magazine. And she called me to say, Michael, my grandfather was a huge impact on my life and somebody who I admired a great deal. And he built the house I was born in without a blueprint. He was a
wow.
You know, he dropped out of school in the seventh grade to work. But by the time he was 30, he was an electrician, a steam fitter, a pipe fitter. He's a mechanic, architect. He just did all that stuff instinctively. And I was sure I was going to follow in his shoes. But, you know, the handy gene is recessive, tragically. And so I wound up in the entertainment business. And working at Evening Magazine at CBS, my mother called me. I was sitting in my cubicle and she said, Michael, you know, your grandfather, he's not going to be around forever. He's 91 years old. I was just thinking, wouldn't it be great if before he died, he could turn on the television and see you doing something that looked like work?
Love it.
So, you know, as usual, my mother was right. And I thought, you know, why not? I'm sort of hosting this show, correspondent working in it, and I can do pretty much whatever I want. So the next night, I took Evening Magazine into the sewers of San Francisco and hosted it from that location. And what happened to me in the sewer with the sewer inspector and the rats and the giant river of crap and all the condoms and disgusting paraphernalia that you find yourself squatting in. I mean, it was all so awful and great and weird that I put that on the air on Evening Magazine, which ultimately got me fired from that show, but
really?
But laid the groundwork for what became Dirty Jobs.
Yeah. What was the worst or hardest dirty job that you ever did?
Well, I mean, very different, you know. I mean, it's hard to compare like the backbreaking manual labor of a concrete chipper with just the incredible, disgusting stench of a lift pump
right.
repair technician. So getting a ruptured lift pump out of a pumping station, you know, requires you to literally swim through raw sewage and crawl up on top of this 4-ton motor that they winch out of this 5-story shaft. And there's no way to describe it. You do it. And when you hear the sound that a ruptured lift pump makes when it breaks the seal of crap that's been holding it to the floor, you know, that'll haunt your dreams. And
Okay. So we'd have to break it down into categories, I guess. What yeah. you're saying.
Yeah. But actually, you know, I mean, concrete chipper was a great dirty job and one I don't often talk about, but at night, hundreds of concrete trucks all get returned to a yard, a big yard. And inside of the drums is a lot of hardened concrete, because every time the drum turns, a thin layer sticks to the previous layer and it hardens. And so after 8 hours of turning, the inside of a concrete drum winds up being about a half the size that it was in the morning.
Interesting.
Right. So all that hardened concrete needs to be chipped out every night. And so men go into these drums with these pneumatic jackhammers that weigh about 90 pounds. And you've got eye protection, you've got ear protection, you've got a mask, you're totally claustrophobic. And you literally lie on your back with this 90-pound gun and just...
Wow. Yeah.
And it takes, you know, an hour.
Hard work. I never even thought about that.
It is backbreaking. And yeah. You know, you got to throw the chunks out and, you know, then you move on to the next one.
Yeah.
Every night, seven nights a week, it never stops.
Yeah, I never thought about it. It does. I always wondered why it doesn't harden in the drum, but it must eventually.
It does. Okay, so it absolutely does.
That's the answer. Okay. Were there any jobs on the show that you ever turned down? They're either too dangerous or too gross.
But not for the reasons you think. It wasn't about too dangerous and it wasn't about too gross. It was very important to me on that show to be able to infuse a measure of humor mm-hmm. into each episode, because I wanted to challenge the idea that dirty jobs were always drudgery. I mean, they were dirty and they were hard, and some of them were backbreaking and some of them were miserable. But everywhere I went, there was always a great gallows sense of humor among the guys mm-hmm. who did the work. And so I always wanted to make sure that was in the show. So when they pitched ideas like crime scene cleanup.
Okay.
Yeah. Or was a good one, body yeah. farm technician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Battlefield medic. Not a lot of laughs there, I guess. Yeah.
It's, you know, yeah. When you put a corpse into the trunk of a Pinto and then submerge the Pinto in the Atchafalaya swamp for 2 weeks and then pull the Pinto out and open the trunk in order to better understand what a corpse looks like that's been submerged yeah. for 2 weeks in the Atchafalaya swamp. Well, that is a dirty job, but yeah. you just can't joke about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Now, to go back to your latest show, 6 Degrees. One of the things that I enjoyed about it is you actually sort of break the fourth wall on this show and walk in and out of the set, reveal the behind the scenes of a production and the people involved and what they do. That seems very consistent with your brand to show sort of the inner workings of things. Was that a big part of the appeal to you?
It was critical. I mean, I don't know that I would ever do another show that doesn't incorporate to some degree what I call the truth cam, mm-hmm. which is just a behind the scenes camera that always rolls. That was a transformational thing in Dirty Jobs because it allowed me to always keep the show on its feet, even when something technical might happen that forced us to stop, or mm-hmm. you know, a plane flies over, or any number of things happen.
Right.
And so in those moments, I would always turn to the truth cam and just tell the viewer what was going on, how I was feeling, what's going on with the crew. You know, the crew also became a very important part of that show, because filming Dirty Jobs is very much a dirty job. And I wanted the viewer to see that too. And there was a lot of resistance in those days. You just didn't show how the sausage was made. You didn't show the crew members. You didn't show any of that. So I was pretty dogged on wanting that to happen. And as a result, we wound up staying on the air a long time. And I wound up being able to reinforce a relationship with the viewer that showed them, look, we don't do second takes. We don't write scripts. We don't pre-produce, you know, and you can see it all from that camera's perspective. So you don't need to use it a lot. It's like salt on a meal.
Right.
You know, you need some, because it's the thing that reminds the viewer that you're telling them the truth. And that was hugely important. So on 6 Degrees, it was the same argument. It was like, look, I know it's not Dirty Jobs, you know, it's a much cleaner proposition, but I'm kind of interested to see what it looks like to make a history show for people who normally don't watch history shows.
Yeah, and I love the puppet reenactments. Who did the puppets in this?
Yeah, well, I was like, you know, look, why not? You know, we're on a budget. I mean, I'm traveling through time on a budget with a bunch of recreators and my best friend, Chuck, from high school, who plays 40 different historical figures in very dubious and suspicious <He's great. laughs> outfits and wigs. You know, the show is not about trying to, you know, blow you away with production value, but I can't recreate the San Francisco earthquake on the budget that I had, but I can use puppets. and so we do.
Yeah.
And look, it's just a kick, you know, it's kind of like the whole feeling was what would a show look like if a few friends who were reasonably intelligent sat down and drank a bunch of bourbon and decided to try and figure out how to connect these two seemingly right. disparate points. The feeling that the viewer should get is that they didn't drink so much bourbon that they got sloppy and stupid,
right.
but they did drink enough to really take all the pretense out of a history show
mm-hmm.
and to make it look and feel yeah. not like a lecture or a sermon, but like a romp.
Yeah.
That's what yeah, we were going.
It was a lot of fun. I learned some stuff. You got a great sense of humor. It was funny, entertaining. I actually like Chuck. he's not the greatest actor in the world, but you know what? he adds something for sure. Yeah, absolutely loved it. Now, real quickly before we go, I also want to mention that you have this wonderful foundation that you started a few years ago, Micro Works. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do and where people can go to support it?
Sure. MicroWorks was launched on Labor Day of 2008 when Dirty Jobs was at its height and our economy was slipping into a terrible recession. I did it because everywhere I went on Dirty Jobs, even as unemployment was rising, we saw help wanted signs. And it became obvious that, you know, the number of people who were out of work really didn't have anything to do with the number of opportunities that were actually available. It was just a mismatch of skills. So what were these jobs that weren't being filled was my question. And the answer were about 2.3 million dirty jobs, jobs that required a training, not a four-year degree. So I set up a foundation whose main purpose was to be a PR initiative for these jobs that for whatever reason were going largely, you know, unloved. And it worked. It morphed, in fact, a couple years later into a scholarship fund. And today we award $1 million a year in work ethic scholarships to kids who want to learn a skill that's actually in demand. So it too was actually inspired by my grandfather, the same guy who inspired Dirty Jobs with a little help from my mother, who shamed me into the sewers of San Francisco. but today, MicroWorks is 13 years old, coming up on it anyway. And we're chugging along. I mean, it really, legacy is one of those words I'm kind of suspicious of. But if a TV show is going to have a legacy, then, you know, a foundation like this coming out of a show like Dirty Jobs, yeah, it feels pretty great. So yeah. we're going to stick yeah. with it. It
sounds like you're doing a lot of great work. Certainly there are a lot of people who are getting angry at universities these days, especially when, you know, you can't get all the money that you put down during the pandemic and all that. But
it's so nuts. Yeah. $1.6 trillion yeah. in student loans currently wow. on the books. 7.8 million open jobs pre-COVID. God knows how many now when we come out of this thing. And we're still, you know, we're still pressuring kids to borrow money they're never going to be able to pay back to get degrees that really aren't leading to the jobs they think they're going to have. It's a problem, and you know, we're trying to push back against it.
Yeah. Good for you, man. Well, again, folks, go check it out. MicroWorks Foundation. What was that? MicroWorks.org?
Yep. That's the one.
Okay.
My
Terrific.
Name followed by Works. We're apply for a work ethic scholarship. We're going to open the next round probably next month. We're always auctioning stuff off to raise money, and you know, deduction or contributions are tax deductible if you're
Good
so inclined.
For you. Yeah, folks, go check that out. 6 Degrees with Mike Rowe is currently available on Discovery's streaming service Discovery Plus, and I also want to plug your podcast, The Way I Heard It. Mike Rowe, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to Mike Rowe for coming on the show. Once more, check out his new series, 6 Degrees with Mike Rowe, now available on Discovery Plus. Subscribe to Mike's podcast, The Way I Heard It, wherever you like to listen, and learn more and support the Mike Rowe Works Foundation at MikeRoweWorks.org. Keep up with Mike at MikeRoe.com and on Twitter at Mike Rowe Works. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kickass News Pod and recommend us to your friends on your social media.
For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.